Welcome everyone to another week of Team Early Childhood Podcast. I'm Aaron Bradbury, your host, and we've got the fantastic Dr. Emma Maynard with us. Hi, Emma.
Hi, Aaron. Good to be with you today.
How are you?
I'm okay. I'm in that slightly seasonal panicky phase where I know that Christmas is going to happen at any moment and it's just going to sneak up on me. So apart from that, I'm just busy and doing lots of exciting things at the moment. So.
Oh, great. So, Emma, just to let you know, with everybody who listens to our podcast know that we've already prepared our questions. And I always ask the fifth question, which obviously isn't on the list, but I ask everybody the same one. I don't introduce you. So are you happy to do your introduction and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, do you want me to do that now?
Yeah, cool.
Okay, right. I'm Emma Maynard. Yes, recently-ish become a doctor, Emma Maynard. And yes, I've been in academia now for 10 whole years. Before that, I was a manager in early health services in social care. So my research and my teaching is still very much with a practitioner eye. I'm a mum. I live in the south of England. And I have two kittens and a husband. That'll do, I think.
I think it's also fair to say that me and Emma know each other quite well, don't we, Emma? Because I've been a part of your journey, your academic journey, for the past 4 years as your external examiner at Portsmouth. So
lots of fun and games, yes.
Yeah, it was great. I really enjoyed it. You know, the best thing about being an external at your place is that you get to go to that lovely shopping village and you're by the sea. So what more do you need? You know?
It's quite sad at the moment though, because we're just about to come out of the second lockdown, aren't we, at the moment?
Yeah.
And if you go down there now, it's just deserted and there's just security guards. It's all quite sad and bleak. But I'm looking forward to it opening up again. Very pretty at Christmas. I shall be shimmying my way down there in a spare 10 minutes, I think.
Oh, well, that sounds great. So, Emma, so you're going to be talking to us this week, very much linked to your research, which is around kind of working with families, but the main thing is around family stories. Could you just give us a brief kind of background on what you've done with families and what you're looking at now?
Well, you see, as I mentioned, my research interests and my teaching interests are very much about what is going on for families with complex needs, having had a career in social care. And understanding what that means for different families. And when I'm talking about complex, I'm thinking about disadvantage, healthcare needs, which are chronic and quite debilitating sometimes, forms of abuse and neglect across generations, all kinds of things, and understanding what it's like to be in those family environments, what it's like for children, and also what it's like for parents. So the research I'm doing now was prompted by my own doctorate. I know you, Aaron, are halfway through your EdD.
Yeah.
And my EdD was absolutely inspiring, and for me anyway, and led me to a much bigger research project. So I'm working with a local authority. And in particular, what I'm looking at is, why is it that some families make progress and things are much better and cases are closed and that's it? Pretty much forever, they do really well, and it was just an episode in their lives. And other families make progress for a little while, and then they go through many more cycles of intervention. And we know that that accounts for over 50% of families in the system and the people that are trying to support them at any one time. So I'm really fascinated with what accounts for the difference between the families who really take that intervention and it really makes a massive difference to them and their children, and for those who just find it really hard to sustain that and they go back into periods of crises again and again.
Yeah.
So the story behind all that.
Do you find that we as practitioners sometimes are very kind of looking through one lens and not kind of looking holistically about, you know, how parents perceive our help, you know?
Well, I think it's a really complicated picture. And the fact is that when you are in practice, you have one main area that you need to look at predominantly. And in terms of social care, and I really believe it's hearts and minds, is that the most important thing that they do is to think about the risk around the child, and there isn't the time necessarily to look beyond that risk. And yeah. I'm curious about whether that's the reason why things come back again. But it's very much in a context that I know that it's not because of a lack of interest, it's because of the immense pressures that are like, make sure this child is safe, make sure the next child is safe, and on and on and on. And so I'm not taking issue with any of that. But I think the systemic stuff, the stuff that's been going on for many years, is probably bubbling through. And while we generally criticize the system for listening more to adults than they do to children, I'm not sure we really tune into the parents' actual story. The story of what it feels like to them to be in the middle of that intervention, and how that then determines how they respond, what they say, how they present themselves. And that's coming from a really deep psychological position. And that's what I'm particularly focused on at the moment, is the story of the parent and what it was like to ask for help, what it felt like, and what was most meaningful while that help was continuing, and how it makes sense in context of the rest of their lives. Yeah. And I think that's a bit of a hidden story that we haven't really grappled with yet. And might just tell us a bit about how that help can last a lifetime.
Yeah, and I love the fact how you've coined it a story, really, because actually there is always a bit of context to everything, isn't there?
Definitely.
And it's really, really important that we listen to that story. Okay, so question number one.
Yeah.
So what do parents say about receiving help, and what seems to matter most to them?
Well, this was the thing that really got me hooked, because when I did my doctoral research, I was expecting parents to talk about their relationship with their workers, and that it was difficult to ask for help, and the sort of things that we have as an established narrative. But actually, they went way beyond that. They did talk about how important their workers were, definitely. But the thing they talked about most was feeling calm. And what struck me was that we never refer families because the parent needs to feel calm.
Yeah.
We refer families because of what we see happening with the child and the risk. But the parents didn't talk about that. Parents talked about what it was like to feel calm in combination with a practitioner who got alongside them. And calm was the thing that came up. One lady actually spoke about being calm something like 30 times in the space of her interview of about an hour.
Right.
And it's just like, wow, that is how significant it was to her. And in the context of a life that was full of violence and abuse and crisis, and everything was highly dramatic. Every single little tiny event was really, really dramatic and really emotionally laden. And so the contrast, I could just see this immense contrast between her lived experience and then what the practitioner had brought to her, was being able to feel calm and being able to feel calm again. And that was what she was trying to get hold of, was now that she'd felt it, how could she get it back again? How could she call that sort of voice of calm and reason in everyday life?
Yeah.
So it was stuff like that. It was the fact that people had been seen, had been heard, that people came alongside them, and that it helped them feel like less of a bad mum, was something that was said quite a lot. You know, I don't feel like such a bad mum if my practitioner comes with me into school, literally standing next to her.
Yeah.
Made her feel like she had an ally. And it's that sort of softer stuff that doesn't necessarily come up on any of our kind of accountability frameworks anywhere. Yeah. But it was so the things that mattered most to parents were not the things that we refer for. And so that's, you know, hence this big research journey that I'm on now.
And it's kind of the soft things that we, you know, I mean, I was one of the lucky ones to work in social care, as you know, within early childhood. And I think, you know, as practitioners, we get so hung up on, you know, the outcomes that we're, you know, that bloody assessment that we have to do, you know, but actually we never go past. And I like that idea of calmness, because for somebody who's in chaos, that can make a massive difference, can't it?
Well, exactly. Yeah. And especially when there's such striking accounts of not just there was violence, but the way in which the violence felt.
Yeah.
And incredible imagery used by some of the parents that I spoke to about, you know, it was like a motorway pileup and a roundabout. And this, you know, this sort of feeling of mass trauma that happened very frequently. And we know that intellectually, we know that what's happening. But the fact that I'm going to the story, for me, keeps it in a much more raw and emotive sort of place. And it keeps me in touch with what this really means to those individual lives.
Yeah.
Which is why I like that kind of perspective on it.
So we hear this kind of word going around quite a lot. So, and that is early help.
Uh-huh.
So what do you think about the term early help, Emma?
Well, I think it's a very contested term. None of the families I've spoken to so far within the early help service have actually been talking about their first point of intervention. They have all been families who've been much higher up. And so they're in early help as a step down from social care.
Yeah.
And also, we, you know, those of us in the sector really know that there's nothing very early about those thresholds into early help. Things are already really very well established. Our schools and nurseries have been trying to hold those children for a long time before our colleagues in the social care part of the service are able to step in. So there's nothing very early about the threshold, but also a huge amount of the work going on is actually long-term stepping down. And I think what early help really means is at the last point of contact, they were less critical than other families. And I think it's so important that we keep that in mind, that it does not mean this is a nipping in the bud type intervention. This is incredibly complex, skillful work that's happening within the early sector, whatever. And also that the parents that we're seeing at that apparently early help stage have very often come from these similarly challenging backgrounds themselves. So yeah, it might be early in the life cycle of the specific issue at the time, but it doesn't mean it's early in the life of that person.
No.
Or early in the life of that family. So I think it's a term that helps us feel like we're doing something at an earlier stage, but I'm really, really not convinced that that's the case. And I think we need to take issue with it. I think we need to push back as a sector.
I think,
I mean,
if you flip the narrative there,
yeah.
I mean, a lot of early help services don't really start until the child kind of formally attends certain services. So you could argue, I know that, for example, health visitors and you know, they are classed as an early help, you know, they can be part of an early help kind of approach.
Yeah.
But it seems to be that, you know, anybody can be an early help professional, which is great in theory, but how does that relate actually in practice?
Well, I think there's a distinction as well to be made between universal services and early help stage. And universal services is everybody,
yeah,
who isn't in the specialist services of social services and CAMHS. So anybody who's a midwife, a health visitor, a teacher, an early years practitioner, anybody who sees children on a regular basis across the spectrum would be a universal service.
Yeah.
And then that early help stage is actually that bit that is just before social care.
Right.
And I do think there's a distinction. And also when we say, you know, people like health visitors and teachers, and, you know, they work across the entire spectrum. So they're working with children who are confidently meeting their milestones and the most at-risk children out there. So they've got that entire spread all the time.
Yeah.
And only a very small proportion of those children will be early help. They're either before that or, you know, a few will be after that. So, yeah, I think, you know, and I think we need to create this narrative of just how complex this work is.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, I kind of worry that we coined early help as meaning everything.
Yeah.
You talk about that universal offer, but I don't know whether that is kind of the approach across the UK. I think that, yeah, lots of professionals offer universal services, but I don't know if that distinction is necessarily there. Understanding, I probably would rather rephrase, that actually that understanding is necessarily there.
Yeah, I think it's possibly that, and possibly about acknowledging that there is a massive resourcing gap, that, you know, having led multi-agency practice with lots of colleagues across the sector, when schools, nurseries would bring cases to us and say, you know, we've done everything we possibly can, and yet they're still not meeting the thresholds of those other services. And that's because of the, you know, huge levels of need, the other side of that barrier. But, you know, there's that real tension between, well, we're exhausted, we've done everything, we can't think of anything else now, and holding that, which are, you know, hats off to people who are out there doing it. I just get to talk about it these days. But I think it's an extraordinary position to be in, and huge amounts of risk being held by people there.
Yeah, I agree. So you talked about change. So the next one is obviously a lasting change. So do you feel that, is lasting change actually possible?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's possible. But I think I probably said earlier, track slightly, but I probably said earlier that only a proportion of people coming through the system don't come back again. So if you look at the figures, within 5 years, over 50% of families will have come back again. So the good news story in that is that around about 50% don't come back again. And that is probably because the help they had was so successful that they don't need that help again. And that's amazing. That is fantastic. And what I'm trying to do now is to find out what happened in those stories. You know, what those people are, the exceptions, they're the successes. So we need to understand what went so well, what made the difference and enabled those people. And actually, in the cases I'm looking at now, not only did they not need more help, but they became advocates of it for other families. They've become peer mentors and they've gone out there and spread the word and looked at things completely differently. So that is amazing. I don't think we really truly know what makes the difference between those families and the people that keep needing us again and again. And that is actually occupying a phenomenal amount of resourcing. And when you think of the human need behind that story, that's the real driving force. Yeah. So yes, it's possible, but I don't really think we know how.
What helps us make that lasting change possible then? So what would your ideal be to make that change possible?
Yeah, I think we need to understand this as a psychological perspective. I am a psychologist, so I'm naturally going to go towards that. But if you look at what happens in when we experience trauma or something jars with our expectations of how things should be, and that model of cognitive dissonance, when people are either, they kind of do one of three things. They either go, okay, this is new, this is something I've got to embrace, I can learn, I can thrive with this, and those would be our successes. Or they pretend like it's not happening because they can't really cope with it. And those people are possibly the families who struggle to engage or struggle to engage meaningfully. And the others are, you know, yeah, I can do this and I'm going to try, but it's more of a kind of fake it till you make it kind of position where it's very hard to sustain without that help. So I think the people that keep coming round again are probably those last two groups of people. And we all do it. We can probably relate to ourselves in this around COVID, or around any major change we've had in our own lives, you know, relationship breakups or, you know, something that is fearful. We can hide from it. We can, you know, try so hard that, you know, all of our energy goes into trying to cope and look like we're doing okay. Or we can just pretend that it's not going on. And I think it's a very, very human response. And when people come in to our services, they're grappling with things that are very deep rooted, like, am I a good enough mum? And that is so morally laden and so scary to open up that conversation.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that going on. There's a lot about what it feels like to ask for help and how big is the gap between what we are saying is the way to cope with your children versus the way that you've always done it. How big is that gap that we're asking people to step across? Because it might be like a chasm. They might not have anything beneath their feet to support it. So I think it's about all of that. I think that's where this gap is between those that come back and those that don't.
And I think this is really, really interesting because I think would you agree that it's probably a timely piece of research, specifically as the need for families and parents and carers and children are probably going to be exacerbated because of the current climate.
Yeah.
Would you agree that it's time for us to really kind of understand what type of early help we're offering and actually what that lasting change could possibly look like?
I do. And it's a pragmatic answer, to be honest, Aaron, but we know, you know, news out this morning about how grim the financial outlook looks. Yeah. And I turned it off. I have to say, I just don't want to listen right now. But you know, that message is things are clearly going to be hard moving forwards. And, you know, there is, you know, I'm not going to suggest that we can wave a magic wand and make all go away. What we are going to have to do is be really smart, really efficient at how we can make change in families. And some of that is probably an honesty thing about, you know, we can't actually improve the financial outlook for families from our type of profession.
Yeah.
But we might be able to help them cope with the difficulties they've had in a better way. And yeah, so I suppose there's never been a greater need for it in some ways.
Yeah, great. Well, that's really, really interesting. Now, I've got a couple of more questions because obviously from the discussion, I'm thinking, oh, what about this? Oh, what about that?
Yeah. So, never stop now. We're on
a roll. Yeah, so we all know, some people might not know, but you're going to be coming and talking about this in greater detail at the Early Childhood at the Heart conference online in January.
I'm looking forward to that. Yeah.
So hopefully we'll have some visuals and an opportunity for people to ask questions, which will be great.
Definitely. Hair, makeup, the works.
Yeah. but what, you know, I'm just sitting here thinking, what about a book, Emma? Is there a book on this potentially on the horizon? Or?
Well, there could well be. I mean, by the time I come in January, I'm literally recruiting now for the next phase of the research. So by the time I come in January, I'm hoping to have some, you know, some more data to impart and some more thinking around this. And ultimately, although I'm talking about parents right now, I would like this to extend out to whole families.
Yeah.
And find out the children's stories too. You know, that's where I started, but it's just like, oh, what's going on with the parents? So yeah, definitely. I think, let's make a big splash, you know.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. I'd be really interested. I mean, we've got lots of books out there on multi-agency and,
you
know, this would be a really great addition to that, but a different narrative, which I think is really, really
exciting. You know, I think we're in an exciting time for all of this. And so, yeah, if there's anybody listening out there thinking, oh, this kind of fits with a bit that I'm doing, please let me know. Yeah. Because I just love a good conversation, I think. I've always been a chatter.
So what are we likely to see from you probably in the next, say, 12 months?
Oh, my God, the pressure. I'm hoping to have got some more published material out there. There's also some other projects going on for me, which is around children and young people's mental health and well-being. So there's this, you know, my stuff is all around families, and I'm working with practitioners to think about how we impact practice. So what I'm doing right now in the research is that I'm directly hooked up with Early Help Service, and we are working out together how we can pilot different ways of working with families based on this research. So in the next 12 months, I would hope to have something a little bit more concrete to be able to say, we've tried this and we think that this has got legs and we're going to try and extend it further. I think with any research project, you have to be really careful in knowing the limits of what you're able to do right now. Yeah. And this needs to be careful. It's intricate and it needs it needs to be given the respect it deserves in terms of, do you know what, if I have to sit with it a little longer, that's what I have to do. But yeah, I would hope to be moving further towards some practice intervention type stuff, and some publications would be on my list.
So my last question
yeah, go on.
Is, if I granted you 3 wishes,
yep,
what would they be?
Well, wishes for me or wishes for...
It's entirely up to you. Nobody said they want to win the lottery yet.
Now, that's always an interesting one, because it's like, why do you want to win the lottery?
Yeah.
Okay, I would wish for a safe and effective rollout of a COVID vaccine. I would wish for confidence for everybody. That's the thing that I think has hit us most in the last 6 months, or maybe that's me, but confidence in the future.
Yeah.
The thing that I would want for everybody. And kindness, compassion.
Yeah.
That's the thing we lead with, is kindness and compassion. So yeah, those would be my 3.
Fabulous.
I mean, I would quite like another one, that's something around, you know, an almond croissant would be very nice. Yeah.
I'm sure there's a local Tesco somewhere.
Might need a few.
I was going to say, you could, I'm sure there's a nice, you know, bakery somewhere close to you could pop to.
I could pop there. Yeah, it's about a deserving thing, really.
Well, thank you so much. And Emma, please say hello to everybody down in Portsmouth for me.
I will. Yes, yeah. The stuff of legend, Aaron.
Yeah, I mean, I do miss you all. I really, really do. And you were such a lovely, lovely bunch of people.
We loved having you. We're great, actually. I love us too.
Well, I thought you were great too. So say hello to everyone for me, but thank you so much.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's really great to chat, and looking forward to more, and definitely to January. That looks to be a great lineup as well.
Yeah. So if anyone's listening, we've got a few tickets left on the EY Matters website. If you go there on the shop, there are a few tickets available, not many, for the January Early Childhood at the Heart Conference at the end of Jan, and Emma will be one of our keynote speakers. So, yeah, it's really exciting. And now we've got Christmas, Emma, so...
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thanks so much, Aaron. It's lovely to talk. Yeah, all right, take care.
Bye.
Bye.